you very much indeed. Now, we heard at the beginning of that very powerful phenomenological point that the value of a performance, if I remember this rightly, lies in the consciousness of everyone in the room, and obviously we want to involve everyone in the room as much as we can in the course of this performance. But if I can just direct a question before I open it up to Ellen. In what sense is digital performance embodied in a qualitatively different way to old-fashioned instrumental performance? Is there a qualitative difference, or is there merely a degree of kind?
No, I think there is a qualitative difference. And in the longer essay, written essay version of this, I discuss this notion that the laptop performer and theorist Curtis Walker has created, that he calls the disappearing artist. And the idea of the disappearing artist pertained to things like glitch and microsound, really minimalist laptop musics in which the sounds are the artifacts of digital editing. They're like tiny little things. So he suggested that because of the neutrality of digital data, because it's all zeros and ones that could, they don't have a life as any particular representation until they're transformed as such into sound, into text, into video, or what have you. Because of this neutrality, the kind of performance practice of the digital performer, who's just, especially the one just hiding behind the laptop, is particularly self-effacing. They're actually trying to disappear from our sight. And a lot of this has to do with the non-matrixed quality of digital performance, the fact that we don't see the bow across the string that produces the sound. We don't have that cause and effect. We just have actions that have any number of indexes in our regular life, so that email looks the same as improvisational computer making. Now, there's lots of digital performance practices that have fought against this, right, where people are using very elaborate body movements or have developed different kinds of interfaces to bring the body more explicitly back into it. But I think it's that very necessity of having to work around the technology in order to do that really makes the digital world something quite unique.
Let's open it up again. I've got a microphone this side. I think there's one that side as well. So let's have your questions or comments right at the back.
Actually, I think that the relationship that you bring between the string quartet and the laptop performer just now is a little bit touchy territory, because you have a situation with a string quartet where you can have a young quartet playing Beethoven 131 or something, where the way that they hold their bodies, the tension with which they hold themselves is on the same order as the average laptop musician. However, it's necessary, I think, to not reduce, because there's a necessary reduction, because a laptop has email on it, and it also has a piece of proprietary performance software with which a performer has become technologically proficient in the manner of violinist's proficiency, right? So if you have a string quartet playing, say, a Feldman string quartet, and the violist, who has a note that lasts for, 18 counts, and then they let their body tension loose, the performance dies, and the tension, there's something performative that's lost, and embodiment is lost. The same thing that you're talking about with the disappearing laptop performer, there are performers who are interested in that disappearance, and there's a disappearance that happens as a result of the performance. There's nothing to look at, so people don't look at them. So I think there are a lot more shades of gray here than this.
Yeah.
And so I guess my question would be, how are you defining embodiment? Because embodiment shows up in a lot of places, and it gets used by people from psychology and neuroscience and cognitive science, but it's not clear to me that, say, for instance, digital technology is inherently embodied. I'm not sure what that means.
What that means, okay. I think that so let me try to say here what two things. So when I'm dealing a lot with the word embodiment in the work that I'm doing, and I want to use the word embodiment both to think about real material bodies, you know, I've done some work on radio art where I really wanted to think about real people in the studio. So it's not just disembodied sound. There are real people doing real things, have real human contact. Whether that's human to human or human to technology or my slider in the studio to your ears out there, there's a quality of bodies being present. But I also want to use it to think about the tactile experience of performing. This is my real interest here is in this kind of extreme act of performance where communication is made in all kinds of ways that don't necessarily have anything to do with the sounds that are being produced. So you gave some great examples of that with your Feldman example. The reason that I think Hales has this notion of digital technology as being inherently embodied is she wants to say, okay, you can disappear the body, we can have everybody show up in animated figures off in digital world, but our experience of engagement with the equipment, our experience of using it, involves us in a particular context all over again. And, you know, as Laura Kavanaugh says, of course, we make the stuff too, right? These are humanly made things. I think I don't know what's happening over here in the UK, but I think the most exciting stuff that I'm seeing at MuTech and other electronic music festivals right now are live generative performances where video and sound are both being generated by software interfaces, most often created by the artists themselves, who are really going out on a limb in the performance situation to do this stuff in real time live. You know, there's nothing not embodied about that. So I think it's a way of conceptualizing where the mind is and where the kind of performative is, inside the technology.
Any other questions?
Yep.
Hi, do you think the 21st century youth and young adults and even old adults, for want of a better word phrase, are more likely to be susceptible to digital performance as an embodiment experience, given that 20 plus years ago, Kraftwerk simultaneously performed in Paris and London with a Showroom Dummies tour where the embodied experience as an audience was experienced by both pretty much equally, but of course, one was fake and one was real.
Yeah.
Do you think that the youth of, or not the youth of today, but the culture that we live in with the technology actually makes it easier for the audience to get digital performance?
I think it must. I mean, I don't necessarily think that, I like the way that you brought that round to the culture today as opposed to an age kind of thing. Because observationally, you see a whole spectrum of age in the audiences at these festivals that I've been looking at, the technological ones, Send and Receive and MuTech. You'll see the kids and you'll also see, you know, the gray hairs as well. So I do think that it's, many people have observed the incredible normalness, the fluidity that people who've grown up in the digital world have with the technology and how easy it is for them to conceptualize their way into it. And it's obvious that we all have. I mean, think what happens if you're away from your email for a few days or you're, how connected you are in with handheld digital devices. We recently moved thousands of miles away from our home and took our 16-year-old with us, and he's not having any problem at all because his whole life is digital with the people back home anyway, right? So, it's the effects on music of the digital world have been incredibly far-reaching, from the economics of it right to the instantaneous creative mode. And I might say, on a slightly political note, that I think it's made a lot of what we teach in music schools completely redundant. I mean, I have no argument with teaching people how to play acoustic musical instruments. I play one myself, I like it fine. But I don't think all our courses should be designed around how to do ear training that's about pitch and rhythm and harmony. I think we should be teaching people how to listen to sound spectra and how to understand an envelope or, what's in the foreground, what's in the background. I think we need to be practicing the kind of deep listening stuff that Pauline Oliveros has been, and Murray Schafer, others have been advocating for decades.
I wonder if there's not a stage already beyond this. I mean, we talk an awful lot about the privileging of visual sense and therefore visual aesthetics, and then re-privileging the auditive experience. But it seems to me that all you get out of that is a new audiovisual holism that still misses something very profound. Do we not need to rush on and start to look at haptic technologies and touch? I mean, Barry Essen has threatened to build smell and taste into the next Kaleidoscope notion. Yeah. But don't we have to go that bit further, that bit faster?
Absolutely. And of course, this stuff doesn't only exist in the high-tech realm. There's a Canadian composer named Armory Schaefer who wrote a very terrific book on sound called reissued as The Soundscape. It used to be called The Tuning of the World, back in the 70s. And for the last 20 years, Schaefer has been taking a group of people, amateurs, professional artists, kids, grown-ups, out to the Canadian wilderness, where they do a week-long performance, where the audience slash participants slash performers, they're all one, are separated out into four different kind of geographical regions. So you're several kilometers away from the next group of people. No electronic technologies. If you want to go talk to someone, you hike in canoe or whatever. So it's very back to the land and has all kinds of problems with it that way, in a sense. But what it does do is say that making art is about being cold or being dry, about what you smell, about traveling the same trails day and night, day and night, day and night, making music in these same places that have different acoustics at different times of the day. You really get a kind of what he called the confluence of the senses. You know, this is far beyond Wagner's Gesamtkunstwerk, right, which is already moving in that direction. This is really a saying that what you hear is affected by whether your belly was full or empty, whether you've got digging the latrine on your mind or canoeing to the next camp or trying to produce a soprano aria in 10 degrees Celsius weather or whatever. I think there's been lots of, you know, this notion of synesthesia is a 19th century romantic aesthetic notion. That's nothing new.
Murray Schaefer won a permanent place in my heart writing a piece of music for snowmobiles and Small Lake. I
think yes, North White. Yeah, yeah.
That's given. Yeah. Any more questions? There's one at the back here.
I missed the beginning of your talk, so you may have addressed this there, but I wonder whether you could say a little bit about your investment in kind of foregrounding embodiment. The sort of discourse of embodiment is pretty pervasive, and I'm always a little bit curious about what drives it. I understand, of course, that there's a certain worry about digitalization and the sort of its microscopic nature. It's non, you know, and it's not sort of visually apparent, and that kind of Cartesian imagining that somehow or other bodies will either disappear or are uninteresting, etc. It's always seemed to me that it's really easy to dispel that idea, insofar as there's only matter, and there's only stuff, and of course, I mean, everybody knows digital things are stuff too. They're just small stuff locked up in boxes that's hard to get at. And of course bodies manipulate them. Of course bodies are doing, in some sense, the same thing that they've always been doing, right? The discussion about laptop performance was interesting in that regard. Yeah. So anyway, I wonder if you could say more about what drives the kind of interest in embodiment for you.
That's both an easy question and a really complicated one. I'll answer the easy part first. The easy part is that I'm a performer, right? I'm not a disciplined ethnomusicologist, despite the word that showed up in my bio there. I'm really someone who comes through cultural studies from being a performer and who grew up in a very conservative music training environment in which people who played music weren't supposed to think about it. I mean, maybe you have a much more progressive education system here, I'm sure you do. But certainly in the States and in Canada, traditional music schools still divide you from composers, players, theorists, historians, and you're really not supposed to have anything to do with those other people who do those other things. It's a bizarre kind of realm and not at all like your visual arts realm. So as a performer, I was always curious about the thing that I felt was most potent about music making, which was not the piece of paper and the dots on it, but the being there in the moment when it was made, either as a listener or as a maker. So that's where my own personal investment in looking at performance as a site for analysis as opposed to works. Yeah. The larger question, though, you have really brings us into the whole notion of what counts as a body, right? I mean, I think embodiment matters because, as Hale says, you know, we have a long tradition now of thinking about the discursive creation of bodies. And that can mean bodies that are marked, black bodies, gay bodies, disabled bodies, right? You know, male bodies, female bodies. To think about the nature of an artistic engagement with bodies is to suggest that you can't, or that we ought not to, overlook the kind of crisis moments or moments of communication that can occur in the meeting of specific circumstances, specific bodies. If I focus on those kind of discrete moments and move outwards, I'm very influenced here by Donna Haraway's work, for example, then we perhaps resist the temptation to make great elisions and suggest that, say, digital music is all male, for example, but assumptions that still get made, right? So part of it's a politics that I think really does matter, that we think, that behooves us to think about our relationship to hugely influential things like technology as we're thinking about our social relations in the world. And part of it's just downright personal curiosity. I don't know whether that answers your question. Yeah.
Hi. Picking up that question, really, and sort of framing it as a, I don't know, ecological ethics or something, some ecological responsibility, is there a sense in which listening to and being more attentive to noise, sound, rather than music, allows us to listen to what we weren't hearing before in less programmed forms of environment?
I hope so. There are several ideologies around that, and I would align myself more with Paulina Oliveros here than I would with Murray Schafer or Arne Nordheim or the whole acoustic ecology movement, for this reason, that I think that valuable as Schafer's work has been, there's a huge romance there around his notion of clairaudience. He suggested you should listen. You shouldn't filter out noise. You should listen to it, because only when you hear how horrific the sounds of those airplanes taking off near you are will you lobby your local councils to, you know, demand that the decibel levels be that are allowable be lowered. There's a great romance around that. The piece you talked about is emblematic of that, around the pristineness of an empty environment, of a natural environment, which I don't think is particularly realistic and also doesn't address many different cultures. Paulina Oliveros suggests that we also listen to everything all the time. She says, listen to the voices in your head, too. Listen to your dreams, your thoughts. Really pay attention to your being in the world. And do this so that you will have a sort of foster a more ethical relationship with people around you. And again, it's about this not allowing yourself an escape clause, right? Don't think about everything in a big gloss. Think about things in the moment. So you have to take responsibility for your interactions with others. So in that sense, for sure. Just worry about the utopian kind of claims that can be made around stuff like that. This music will save you, or this practice will save you.
It's interesting that utopianism properly understood, or utopics properly understood,
is
very much about spaces, the ideal spaces, virtual spaces, and so on. And that was really your starting point with your presentation. Is there more theoretical work to be done? Because it seemed to me that utopics, as a quasi-mathematical way, was incredibly exciting in the early 80s, and it's stopped dead at the very point where you needed some applications of those theory, and therefore some extension of that theory. But that seems to have stopped.
Instead, people started talking about dystopias.
Yeah.
Yeah. By smarter cultural theorists than me, for sure. That's not a very good answer to your question. The answer is I think you're right, but I'm not aware of the work that's being done particularly. Yeah.
Do we have any more questions? Well, again, I'm sure there'll be opportunity to pick all these points up again, but just for the moment. And do buttonhole our speakers outside if you have further thoughts or things you want to ask them. But in the meantime, Ellen Waterman, thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much.